From Kinmare to Ballybunion, from Port Magee to Tarbert, your voice in the kingdom, Radio Kerry.
The greatest day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams.
Episode 10 of The Greatest Day recalls the 1931 season. Three in a row was the target for the kingdom this year. It was also a campaign when, arguably, the most sporting gesture in Kerry football history occurred. Throughout the programme, we'll feature extracts from the Kerryman newspaper of that year, voiced by Gary O'Sullivan.
Part 1.
1931 proved to be a trophy-laden year for Kerry. Before securing three in a row All-Ireland titles, they firstly won the National League final, beating Cavan 1-3 to 1-2. In his book, Kerry's Football Story, Paddy Foley, or PF, noted how the subsequent Cavan County Convention said, while some might be jealous of Kerry, they were not, and admired them both as a team and a county. PF also detailed how Johnny Reardon captained the side in the absence of JJ Sheehy. National League success was followed by the Kingdom capturing the Railway Cup. On St Patrick's Day 1931, an all-Kerry team, representing Munster, defeated Leinster 2-2 to 6 points. Next up for Kerry was the McGovern Brothers Cup. The National League and the Railway Cup are well known in GAA circles, but most would not be familiar with the McGovern Brothers Cup. When Kerry toured America in May and June of 1931, the promoters of the tour put up the aforementioned trophy. This tour came 4 years after Kerry had previously been to the US. The Kerryman newspaper was keen that its fellow county men stay at home in order to prepare properly for the All-Ireland Challenge and avoid the pitfalls which befell the Kerry tourists of 1927. Following the Tipperary precedent, it may be taken for granted that the team will return stale and may lose their title. In 1928, Kerry had lost to Tipperary in Munster, 1-7 to 2-3, with many laying the blame at the feet of the decision to make that US tour. However, as regards the trip of 1931, the 1970s publication Years of Glory pointed out, an all-important consideration was that Tralee Sportsfield was to benefit to the tune of £500 by the trip. So the tour went ahead, Kerry remaining unbeaten throughout. Years of Glory told how Kerry played in front of over 60,000 spectators at New York's Yankee Stadium, then 45,000 in Chicago. Kerry also lined out in Philadelphia and Boston. Legend has it that renowned boxer Jack Dempsey, said to have mid-Kerry connections, put up one of his cups and a set of gold medals for one of the matches. The New York Advocate, quoted by PF in his book, stated that Kerry were a credit to the Irish race, high-class, intelligent young athletes, at home in any company. The Kingdom were proclaimed champions of the world. Parades were held for the players when they returned home, but bigger and more important tests lay in store. Also in the USA in 1931, the Empire State Building was officially opened. The Star-Spangled Banner became the official national anthem of America. Less than a decade before, Kerry was in the midst of the Troubles. Teammates on the football pitch were on opposite sides in the Civil War. There were Republicans such as John Joe Sheehy, while Con Brosnan was a captain with the Free State Army. For the 1924 Munster final, which took place at a time when Sheehy was on the run, Brosnan guaranteed Sheehy a safe passage. It was neither the first nor the last time that this happened, be it Sheehy or others. Brosnan and Sheehy played alongside each other in the Munster final of 1924, as they did throughout that championship-winning campaign. Brosnan's actions were not forgotten. He was rewarded with the Kerry captaincy in 1931. Joe Barrett was the man behind this most magnanimous of sporting gestures. Joe Barrett's son, JJ, explains.
My dad decided the Stacks had won the championship and they had the nominating of the captaincy. So it was my dad who would have been getting it, and he decided he was going to hand it over to Con. Now, Con had been a Free State soldier, and my dad would have been on the opposite side during the Civil War. So my dad gave it to Con, and there was a lot of controversy, but they overcame it anyway.
Local historian Ryle Dwyer is in no doubt that Joe Barrett's gesture would not have been met with widespread approval.
Well, Joe Barrett had captained the Kerry team, I think it was in 1929, when they won the All-Ireland, and then the Austin Stacks had won the county championship, so he was invited to captain the team again. But he thought that the honour should really be given to Con Brosnan. So he offered the captaincy to Con Brosnan. I'm sure there were undoubtedly some people in the Aston Stack team felt that they were part of the team. They should have been offered it before an outsider, but they still weren't prepared to stand up to Job, and they were prepared to accept his choice. And Job felt that Con Brosnan deserved the recognition because he was a Free Stater. He had been a captain in the Free State Army, and he had provided the safe passage for Republicans during the earlier years. And as a result, Con Brosnan ended up Captain Kerry to their first three in a row.
Con Brosnan's son, Jerry, says he and his father had a good relationship with Barrett's club. Jerry is glad his father was afforded the opportunity of captaining Kerry, an honour the Moyvan man was unlikely to gain otherwise.
They made him captain then. He couldn't, they never won an all, they won a county championship. And they were the three team just come out here and we just have to make an old field for them. The sports field wasn't that time back there now. And we'd have to line the field 3-4 days before it and get along the field. The best field was my van, like. And get it taken off the man and paid all around it. And for the match of your, the pick everything is loaded for cattle. And they never won. They were never won. And the three team, they thought too much of him for what he'd done on account of, he got him out of jail. He was in the Free State and they were dappled, the children, they were in jail. And he was getting a free passage to get him out and carry him back in again. And that they thought him much, so much of that is that they made him captain.
Kerry were scheduled to play Tipperary in the Munster final on August 9th, with the victors to proceed to the All-Ireland semi-final 3 weeks later. Kerry fine-tuned their play with a comprehensive win over Dublin in a challenge match the week before their meeting with Tipperary. Some familiar faces were missing for the outing against Tip, but nonetheless, confidence remained high.
John Joe Sheehy will be an absentee as he contemplates retirement. John Joe Launders, sit in the States with Ned Sweeney, will also be missing. Thus, Kerry will require a new forward line. It does not appear the deficiencies can be made good from the selected substitutes. But the champions have been so superior in recent years that it would be sensational if the title were lost on Sunday.
Paul Russell was another absentee for the Kingdom.
A special meeting of the Kerry Selection Committee was held to find a new front line and a substitute for Russell. The following were selected: Martin Regan left, Jackie Ryan full, and Tim Landers right. Paddy Whitty filled Paul Russell's place, while Con Ganey was on the right wing.
Martin Regan, better known as Bracker down the years, tells how he got his chance to represent the county.
And one day coming out of Hapistine Mass, we were going down for religious instruction down to the green, and John Hickey met me. He was a Kerry station. "You're on today," he says, "in the Munster final 31 against Tipperary. John Joe Sheehy is retired."
When Kerry took to the field against Tip, they had 11 of the side which started the 1930 All-Ireland final. Johnny Reardon was again in goals. In front of him were Dennis O'Connor, Joe Barrett and Jack Walsh. Tim O'Donnell and Joe O'Sullivan were among the halfbacks. Con Brosnan and Bob Stack held court in midfield. The forward division included Jackie Ryan, Mike Doyle and Eamon Fitzgerald. The forwards, which the Kerry man was reluctant to put too much faith in, came up trumps as the team posted a total of 5 goals and 8 points to Tip's 2 points. It was a stroll in the park for the Kingdom. Moreover, it was the debut of a lifetime for the man who was to become Bracker.
Young Regan made an auspicious debut as forward, and his early goals put the issue beyond doubt. Against the wind, Kerry's newcomer had 2 goals up in the first 10 minutes, and the Kingdom thereafter swamped the opposition. When a long ball was finished by Landers for a goal, the game lost all interest. Keane secured 2 minors for Tipperary. Regan replied with a goal for Kerry, and half-time arrived with the home team leading by 4 goals to 2 points. The second half was altogether in Kerry's favour. Ryan forced his way through for a goal. Kerry scored minors at will, per Doyle and Regan, and a dull game ended with the scores 5-8 to 2 points. The game became a rout long before the whistle, and contrary to their usual practice, the Kerry players kept piling on the agony. It must be remembered that the opposition were very poor. Had the Kerry backs allowed Tipperary to get possession, the Tip forwards would scarcely have located the post.
Even allowing for the quality, or rather lack of, in the opposition, a 21-point victory by Kerry seemed ominous for the rest. Two of the county's exiled stars were on their way home to aid the championship campaign.
A cablegram says that John Joe Landers and Ned Sweeney sailed for home on Saturday last.
Sweeney had been fortunate to cheat death in a car crash in the US. 1 week after their facile victory over Tipperary, Kerry ventured north to meet Ulster. 1970's publication, Years of Glory, noted how keen the province was to see the All-Ireland champions in action.
Kerry made the long journey to Monaghan to play in a football friendly in aid of Three Mile House Catholic Church. Kerry's visit created widespread interest, and all games in Cavan, Armagh, Fermanagh and Monaghan were cancelled for that Sunday. Kerry duly lived up to their great reputation, beating the Ulster side to earn themselves a set of gold medals. Kerry won that game 2-13 to 1-2 in front of an estimated crowd of 11,000.
It was now time to focus on the upcoming All-Ireland semi-final against Mayo.
Recent victories have proved that our men have suffered little by their American tour. Still, no chances should be taken against Mayo. The bane of all champions is overconfidence. Kerry often dearly learned this lesson in the past.
The Western people had confidence in the Mayo men.
Mayo's victories over Sligo, Galway and Roscommon, by wide margins, suggested that the team now doing duty is a force to be reckoned with. Kerry is probably up against a tougher proposition than any they experienced in their all-conquering American tour.
The response was swift and to the point.
Whatever Mayo may think as to the result, it will be sensational if the kingdom go under.
The same edition of the Kerry Man explains that Ned Sweeney is back in the old hometown, looking little the worse after his providential escape from death in the unfortunate Brooklyn accident. Paul Russell returned to the Kerry lineup for the meeting with Mayo. Paddy Whitty, who had played at halfback against Tipperary, was moved to the full forward line. Con Ganey was omitted. An early Jackie Ryan goal set the tone for Kerry to dominate the opening half against Mayo.
A high ball dropping between Moran, Quinn and Ryan was fisted by the last named into the Mayo net. Regan then received and punted a point. Ryan, Fitzgerald and Whitty worked well for the last named to notch an overhead point. Ryan registered a further point from a free 14 yards out. Kerry got a free, Ryan received Russell's kick and placed Doyle for a point. Mayo then attacked and Correll pointed. Whitty took down a high ball and shot a nice point. Regan kicked wide from 40 yards range when he might have placed Whitty for an easy score. Quinn saved a brace of bullet-like balls from Whitty.
With half an hour to go, it seemed like game over for the Westerners, trailing as they did 1-5 to 1 point. But the Munster men had to endure a terrific struggle before advancing to the final.
On resuming, Mayo were again quick to break away. Mayo kept up the attack and their efforts were rewarded with a goal. The kick-out was returned and from a free, Correll scored a point.
Kerry came to the attack and had a 50. Fitzgerald fielded the kick high in the air and kicked a point.
Reardon saved from Correll and cleared to touch. Dwyer received the throw-in and kicked a point. Correll kicked a point amid great excitement.
The deficit was down to 2, but no further score was forthcoming, despite some anxious moments for Kerry.
Mayo had 2 frees, but Correll could not score.
Doyle and Landers had overs at the Mayo end.
The air was electric as the Mayo forwards and the Kerry backs surged to and fro near the Kerry goal, with almost 15,000 throats helping to put the pressure on. Then the ball was in the Kerry net, and the Mayo supporters swarmed over the pitch, waving banners of green and red and cheering wildly. When order was restored, Mayo were rewarded a 50 as the ball had gone over the end line off a Kerry defender and was put back into play by the people who packed the sideline and the end line and encroached onto the playing pitch at times.
The 50 proved fruitless and Kerry had a free, which enabled them to move to the Mayo end.
Play was now confined to the Mayo end and Russell sent in a rasping shot which hit the crossbar. Ryan received the rebound and drove wide.
Kerry hung on to emerge victorious. They won by 1-6 to 1-4 despite putting over just 1 point in the second half. The Irish Times appreciated the efforts of both sides.
Kerry were fully extended by Mayo. It was a thrilling game and there was intense excitement in the last 15 minutes when Mayo forced matters and held Kerry on the defence until the long whistle. Kerry played their usual high-class football, excelled at reaching and fielding, and their forwards were somewhat too good for the Mayo backs. The Kerry full-back, Barrett, was outstanding, with Russell, Whitty and Landers prominent in the forward line.
The other semi-final saw Kildare edge out Cavan by 10 points to a goal and five.
The greatest day. The story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group. Proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Part 2.
Another year, another Kerry versus Kildare final. The fourth between the counties in six seasons. Kerry led 2-1 going into the 1931 encounter. Kingdom forward Martin Bracker Regan recalls the training regime for the final.
It was kind of coolish, you know. Kerry were the top dogs that time. And we trained in Barrettwell areas. And we trained in Barrettwell areas about 3 or 4 hours a day. We were very fit. And when we won the final, we were told, pull up your socks when you won't be in the final. With the semi-final, and he won't be up in Kildare in Dublin for the third Sunday. And the first week in September, we trained in the Old Ladies Hotel, opposite the CY Mess, Spanky's father, and we trained in another hotel, the Ashburn, outside the courthouse, he's gone home, or Grady's. But 9 days training, and we got a big... We got two big checks, £2.10. Well, I was doing a few hustles, I was until then, £2.10 walked.
In advance of the final, the Irish press published pen pictures of some of the Kerry players, giving an insight into the attributes of some of the finest players of their era. John Walsh.
His powers of repulse have become a vital part of Kerry's collective effectiveness.
Eamon Fitzgerald.
Exceptionally fast and elusive in attack, and has been growing more and more formidable in strength each year.
Michael Doyle.
He's a dangerous man in the enemy's lines and will be expected to rise to great heights in this final.
Con Brosnan.
He and his midfield colleague Bob Stack are the fulcrum upon which the lever of victory has often been raised in favour of Kerry.
Bob Stack.
Ever on the alert to aid a repulse or initiate an attack, he has proved invaluable to his side in every critical engagement.
Joe Barrett.
The bastion of the Kerry backline, brains and brawn combine most effectively.
Joe O'Sullivan.
A hefty stalwart, hard to pass and a rock to encounter.
Paul Russell.
A mine of defensive energy with a fine instinct for raiding.
That instinct would be seen in full effect during the final.
The Irish press sought the pre-match thoughts of Kerry forward Michael Doyle, who was in confident form.
Yes, we will win all right. The lads are all fit and well. While we have the greatest respect for Kildare, I think our team is as good as any which has ever done duty for Kerry, and will not be beaten this time anyhow.
Then Kerry County Board Chairman Denjo Bailey was also quoted by the Irish press, and like Doyle, he was backing a Kingdom victory.
I think we'll get there all right. The boys are all in good form, and the latest news tells us that O'Donnell will play. Whitty may fill the full forward position, though Ryan is likely for the honour. The actual forward placings will be decided tonight in Dublin.
PF, in Kerry's football story, told of Kerry reservations ahead of the decider.
JJ Sheehy retired. Filling the position of this prolific scorer was a hard task.
Sweeney, injured in America, was also an absentee. When the Kerry team reached Dublin on Saturday night, it transpired Tim O'Donnell would be unable to play owing to a knee injury. The Kerry team was finally decided upon at midnight on Saturday.
With O'Donnell an enforced absentee, half-forward Tim Landers dropped back to the number 7 slot. John Joe Landers was drafted in at half-forward. The big shock, though, was goalkeeper Johnny Reardon being left off the starting 15. The decision to omit Reardon was forced on the selectors, according to GAA broadcaster Micheál Muirahertig.
Johnny Reardon, he was the goalkeeper. He was supposed to be a marvellous goalkeeper, you know, that he'd read a thing well and supposed to be in a bit of a character as well. Now, he won in 26, he won in 29, 30, 31 then. He had played all the games, he might have won a National League, he had played the All-Ireland semi-final, Munster final. He was togged out in the dressing room to play in the final when he was told by the county secretary he was not playing. And that Dan O'Keefe, the sub-goalie, was going in. Now, I pressed Purty Landers very hard to tell me what happened, and all he would say is he broke training on Saturday night. Now, he wouldn't go beyond that. Maybe the man had a pint or a half pint instead of a bottle of milk or something, but he never played for Kerry afterwards. And, you know, I always hold that chance plays a huge part in the careers of players. Dan O'Keefe might never have played for Kerry if Johnny Reardon hadn't broken training. He was still a young enough man. Goalkeepers have long careers. He would have been there in 32. He possibly would have been there in 37. He might be thinking of retiring around the end of the 30s. And if he would, the logical successor then might have been a player called Brendan Reedy, who won 3 minor All-Irelands as a goalkeeper for Kerry, but never got a game for the seniors because Dano was established. Now, quirk of fate, Dano was a fantastic goalkeeper, set a record that I held for the number of championship games played for Kerry until Dara Shea came along and went over the 70 maybe and beat Dano's record. So,
the absence of such a quartet left Kerry fans worried.
Opinion in Dublin generally favoured a Kerry victory. Many, however, believed that the absence of Sheehy, Sweeney and O'Donnell spelled disaster for the kingdom.
PF, in his book Kerry's Football Story, reminisced.
The Kildare matches generally confronted Kerry with unusual puzzles. The Paul Doyle problem was solved by Paul Russell. In the Leinster Championships, the Kildare Paul always caused havoc. He was on the downgrade at this period, while the Kerry Paul was on the uprise. Jack Higgins, too, was always a thorn in the Kerry side, as was Frank Malone. On their effective answers to these short grass posers depended Kerry's sequence of wins over the Leinstermen. Kildare, likewise, had their worries. Each time they met Kerry, they had a new goalman. They also had a new full forward. Many men were tried and failed in turn to subdue Joe Barrett. Another problem for Kildare was the Kerry centre field of Brosnan and Stack. The pair dominated the Gaelic midfield for a decade. Kildare often made some last-minute positional changes on the original selection. Kerry were sometimes unaware of the definite line-out until after the ball had been thrown in.
The Irish press wondered whether Kerry's early season sojourn to America would catch up with them.
The strain of these feats may tell at length upon the ardour and freshness of the champions.
There was a feeling that they showed a weariness against Mayo in the semi-final. This is not impossible, and those who entertain such doubts cite the fate of the Kerry team of 1928 on their return from the American tour.
On that occasion, Kerry exited the Munster Championship with a shock loss to Tipperary.
The conditions that existed then do not prevail today.
The organisation of the Kerry team remains unimpaired. And that, most potent factor of all, this is an All-Ireland final, not a provincial semi-final. The issue will be alive to the last whistle. I think Kerry will have the game in hands when the anxious moment arrives, but I fear and admire Kildare too much to present my impression as a prediction.
Kildare legend Larry Stanley was also asked by the Irish press for his thoughts on the 1931 decider. Stanley was among those whose train of thought was that the trip to the US might catch up with the boys in green and gold.
I think the issue is pretty open. Kildare has an earnest, capable lot, and nothing is beyond their reach. Kerry, I hear, were weary looking against Mayo. If their strenuous season is telling on them, the same fate may befall them as on their previous return from America 3 years ago. Still, on St. Patrick's Day form, the kingdom stands an undeniable chance and will be hard to beat for another title.
The St. Patrick's Day form, which Stanley alludes to, is the kingdom's 2-2 to 6 points defeat of Leinster when an All-Kerry team captured the Railway Cup. The Irish press also spoke with 2-time All-Ireland winning Dublin player T.H. Redmond.
I like the Kerry game immensely. It has brought them the highest awards, and they should adhere to it. The absence of John Joe Sheehy will be a distinct loss. Of all Kerry players, he was the cutest, and could beat the referee every time by taking risks and exceeding the 4 paces allowed when in possession. Referees are not keen on interpreting this rule strictly, and Sheehy would waltz around, seeking position before playing off. He was all the time inviting a tackle, which invariably resulted in a free, and most times in a point when close in. Landers' play is to be admired. He may not be as robust as John Joe, but he is a fine, robust exponent of the Kerry game and a great point scorer. Kildare show better ball control than Kerry and can weave their way to the objective with more skill than most teams. Paul Doyle is the ablest exponent of this style, and I would even describe him as the best player in Ireland. I think Kerry vigour will have upset the Kildare combination before the hour has gone far.
Martin Bracker-Regan has disclosed how he had to borrow a boot from Dennis Rory O'Connell for the decider.
There were two odd boots. And one of Rory's boots, we had no one to give us boots at the time, so at least we had no sponsors. Two odd boots. And we had Rory's boots. Rory had a high instep, and when he kicked the ball, it got right. Myself and I had no flat insteps. And I could put side to the ball.
The Irish press detailed Kerry's weekend schedule, including a post-match Cayley Moore at which the team's success on the American tour was to be recognised. The paper states that Mrs. Austin Stack will present each member of the team with a copy of the book Story of the GAA. Irish Times correspondent Pat O was keen to discuss the team selections.
A close game is expected, with opinion hardening in Kerry's favour. Examining both teams critically, one must conclude that Kildare are taking the greater risks. Kerry have relied on the team which has performed so consistently in the past. Kildare have sought new inspiration in front of goal. The whole front line has been reorganised. Youth and speed are the keynote in Kildare's new attack. For Kerry, Whitty, who comes on in Sheehy's place, is a versatile man, playing back and forward with equal success. His father, Dr. Whitty, is well known in the Kerry Blue Ring as judge and exhibitor. Landers, junior, small and sturdy, takes Sweeney's place. Kerry will take the field with supreme confidence.
In scoring terms, where it matters most, the first half belonged to the Leinster champions.
The Kildare men swarmed in and Burke from an angle drove over an accurate point after 5 minutes of play. Kerry got under the kick out and Stack was fouled. Landers got the free and he passed to Doyle, who dropped clear over the bar for the equaliser from about 40 yards out. Russell held the kick out. He parted to JJ Landers, who gave to Regan in good ground. He was fouled about 14 yards out, and from the free, Ryan gave Kerry the lead after 12 minutes of play. Paul Doyle, moving in, was fouled.
He took the free and levelled the scores.
Two frees came to Kildare. From the second, inside the 50, Burns sent over the bar, restoring Kildare's lead by a point. Kerry fouled about 20 yards out. D. Burke took the free, the leather hitting the crossbar. A lightning run along the left wing was ended by Byrne, who drove over a great point from a difficult angle. Ryan got the ball at the corner and crossed to Landers. Landers sent in a stinging shot for the goal, and the ball glanced off Goff's hands over the bar for a point. Stack got the throw in and he passed to Ryan, who gave to Landers. Landers, with a nice left, sent high between the uprights, reducing Kildare's lead to a point.
Waters put Kildare on the attack, and H. Burke, fielding a high ball, drove over Kildare's seventh minor.
Kerry, somewhat fortuitously, only trailed by 7 points to four at the break. Thankfully, as the Irish Times recorded,
wise counsels at halftime revolutionised Kerry's display, new forceful tactics were adopted, and their pivotal positions in attack were reversed.
Whitty's youth and speed had been lost on the 7 yards mark. He should never have been placed there. When he came out on Kerry's left wing, his art was seen to full advantage.
He gave Ryan many chances, and they were well used, so the game dramatically swung round in Kerry's favour.
Kerry didn't just dominate the second half, they were awesome.
Kerry swarmed to the attack, a dropping ball from Brosnan reached the square. Whitty got under the leather and punched towards the net. There was great applause from the Kildare following when Walsh held and kicked to safety. Kerry pressed and had a free at 30 yards range. Ryan drove over the bar, reducing the Kildare lead.
Martin sent in a shot which O'Keefe saved for a 50.
A great hand-passing movement by Kildare saw Burke try for a goal. O'Keefe cleared.
Great play by P. Whitty on the wing left Ryan in possession. He raised the white flag amid wild Kerry cheering, and the Kildare lead was reduced to a point.
Kerry had a free which Brosnan landed in the goalmouth. Whitty boxed the ball, but Walsh held safely under the bar and kicked away. Kildare burst away, and a trying tussle in the Kerry goalmouth ended in a free to Kildare. Maguire took the kick and missed a glorious chance. Kerry had a free, which Barrett kicked to Whitty. Whitty drove over the equalising point, 7 each after 18 minutes of play. Two frees went to Kildare, and from the second, Burke restored the All Whites lead with a point. Whitty fielded the goal kick on the 50 and sent a long punt high between the sticks for the best score of the day, setting the teams once more level. Two frees in succession were awarded to Kerry. Ryan took a second about 20 yards out and gave Kerry the lead amid wild cheering from the Southerners' followers. Kerry were playing in winning vein and Kildare appeared to tire. M. Doyle secured the kick out. He passed to Ryan to wheel round Gough and the white flag was hoisted in the champions' favour. Play came to a Kildare end in a flash. Walsh saved from Ryan, but Russell got onto the clearance and a long punt was misfielded by Walsh, who dropped the leather over the line. To make doubly sure, Ryan rushed in and kicked into the net.
The aforementioned Ryan put over the final score of the day, with Kerry recording a 111 to 8 points victory.
The greatest day. The story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group. Proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Part 3.
The following day's Irish press led with the headlines, "Spirited rally that carried Kerry to victory" and "Wonderful back-to-the-wall fight by the champions." The following is a brief synopsis of the Irish press's report on the 1931 final.
Kildare took to the field while the minor hurling final was speeding to a rather tame finish. The stage soon cleared for the all-engrossing event. A shout proclaimed the entry of the Kerry team. They were not only the champions of the homeland, but victors in the greater Ireland beyond the seas. Kildare had its seventh minor to give them a three-point lead at the interval. Never forget that Kerry in arrears is Kerry at its best. There was now only a point between them and 10 minutes of the second half gone. Kerry had now discarded cleverness for vigour and individualism, and they were heading for victory. Kerry seemed confident, and a goal, badly handled by the Kildare goalman, practically put the issue beyond doubt. The Stonewall Kerry defence rose to its best tradition again and again in the closing stages, and all the arts of the Kildare men could not pierce it. Kildare were weakening now. Kerry were playing as of old and finished a victorious team with undiminished honours and all the credit of another glorious game. Kildare played better than the score or any account of the game can convey.
Irish Times correspondent Pat O registered his pleasure with the match.
The game will have satisfied 99% of the 40,000 spectators by reason of its intense nature. By its dramatic change of fortune, by Kildare's distinct superiority in the first half, and more than all, by Kerry's confident recovery from a perilous position and their irrepressible dash when their jealousy-guarded title was all but lost.
Rarely have I marked such a sudden reversal of form on change of sides between the two teams of high reputation, where neither wind nor sun lent favour to either goal. Kildare's football in the first half was collected and sound. Kerry played far below their form and deserved to be further in arrears than their 3 points, 7-4 indicated on the scoring board. Yet it must be said that Kildare were unlucky in many promising movements, and more than one brilliant score of the past was hopelessly at sea near the posts. Paul Russell's long drive from the right should never have passed Kildare backs for a goal, but sportsmen will take their hats off to Kerry. Their reckless abandon and reserve of stamina once again changed defeat into victory.
Among the celebrating Kerry contingent was Canon Jackie McKenna, who later that decade lined out alongside a host of Dingle's Kerry stars.
I boasted the fact that I was at the All-Ireland final of 1931. Now that's a long time ago. I was 11 years of age. My father was going to the All-Ireland, like a true Kerry man. And he took his little boy with him to the All-Ireland Kerry and Kildare they were playing. And I have memories of that, being in Croke Park, 1931, watching Kerry and Kildare playing the All-Ireland final. Kerry won that year. Yes, by train, yes, by train at him. And we stayed somewhere in Dublin that Saturday night and all that sort of thing. Oh my goodness, it was heaven and earth to us, even to see Croke Park. We had heard about it, all right. there was, as you know, in 1931, there wasn't any radio or anything. It was only just starting around that time. They had broadcast matches all right before 1931, but it was very in its infancy and very haphazard, and very few people had radio sets as well. So it was amazing to be there present at the All-Ireland looking on. So one Dingle man that time, Joe Sullivan, he was centre half back on the Kerry team, and he was in that position for a long time on the Kerry team. He was a native of Dingle Parish here, Joe Sullivan.
Paddy Foley's book, Kerry's Football Story, carried an extract from On Phoblacht.
In coming to the core of the matter, to the factors which have ensured the unbroken success of Kerry in recent years, two things stand out alone, spirit and environment. The one is, to a large extent, a consequence of the other. The mountaineer is a better fighter than the man of the plains.
From his infancy, he has something to look up to, something to surmount.
He is impelled to climb the highest peak, to see what lies beyond. The child of the plains has no such incentive.
The plainsmen of Kildare exhausted the resources of training before the decisive stage arrived. The gritful Kerrymen urged on their reserves of energy, born of the will and the desire to climb to the top.
Martin Brecker Regan felt a number of Kerry players excelled against Kildare.
The star that day, though, was Joe Barrett, Jack Welch, Dee Connor, Paul Russell O'Stendy, Georgie said they all played brilliant, and the Landers were great, and Michael won four All-Irelands before he was 21. Great player. It was a very keen game, and we had a hard job to beat him, but they were very good footballers.
Dick Fitzgerald may have passed away 1 year earlier, but his legacy lived on in the 31 decider. GAA historian Tom Looney.
Paul Russell got the key goal to win the match. It was Dick Fitzgerald first. He actually got onto a Kerry team when he was a student at St. Brendan's College on the recommendation of Dickie and Fitz. He had never played a trial game. They said, try him, he's a good young fella. And he scored the key goal, which beat Kildare.
Some years later, Martin Bracker Regan recalled the homecoming of 31.
The homecoming did. We landed in Mallow, and there was Foxy that was there by the Cork Road. Sean O'Sheacon and all those, they loved to see Kerry winning. Wonderful. There was Bon Fersden from Blackmore and along, and we landed Trinity. It was a great reception. Not to a terrible any excitement, but they were kind of used to winning. They brought to come up the street, all right. Con Master was captain that year, Con had the cup. But if we lost the game, the headiness, screeching headline would be the fall of the mighty. How did Kerry lose?
Kerry player of the 1940s, Mick Finucane, remembers listening to that Kerry-Kildare final on the radio. It's not so much the game itself, he recalls, however.
My first memory of Kerry football was a match between Kerry and Kildare. I have a whole lot of matches that was played around that time. And it was a broadcast that was held in the pavilion dance hall in Ballybunnan. With about, there was 400 or 500 people. There was only standing room inside, no one sitting. And the radio was in the middle of the thing, you see, so that hear it at all sides. And there were Robbie Stack and Con Brosnan and Jack Welch were playing in that game. So it had a big local interest as well. And at my age, which would be maybe 8 or 9, maybe 8, I'd say, I really wasn't following the game that much, but I was looking at the crowd and their antics, we call it, because every time there was a score for Kerry, they threw their hats in the air. Now, every man in them days wore a hat or a cap or something like that. And then when they fell down amongst the crowd, there was pandemonium looking for their hat, you see. And I know very well that some fellas came home with better hats than they took there anyway.
Jackie Ryan was responsible for 6 of Kerry's total that day. His teammate in that victory, Martin Bracker Regan, believes Ryan was a class apart.
And I think Ryan was the greatest of them all.
Oh,
as Tim said, he was a stylist.
He
just catched the ball, you know, and got up in the air and he turned the deal. I often tried him when I was born. And he tapped the ball over. From there, is the pavilion now left and right over the bar. And we used to always put the ball over the middle of the bar to cross that because the umpires might be short-sighted.
Kerry footballers by Jerry Daly. For glorious grace and grandiose grandeur, for stately sublimity and supreme splendour, the cream of Gaelic sports hallowed hall is the excellent, exquisite elegance of Kerry football. Magnificent men with majestic mastery, ardent artistry is their august armoury, with splendid style and superb skill, wondrous warriors with what they will. With polished panache they show the way, mighty privileged are all who see them play. With dedication and daring they are driven, their flair and flamboyance give us visions of heaven. No man alive do they ever fear, the word defeat they will not hear. They stride the field with power and vigour, never can one doubt their valour. Now in Croke Park on All Ireland Day, when the going gets tough and some do pray, with expert endeavour and eager elan, fierce fires of fervour they do fan. Their brilliance inspires us and fulfills our dreams. It rouses huge cheers and loud delight screams. Beautiful, bonny, brave and bold are our heroes who wear Kerry's green and gold.
You've been listening to The Greatest Day, a 36-part series documenting the story of Kerry's All-Ireland Senior Football Championship victories. The Greatest Day was presented by John Drummy, written by Joe O'Mahony, and researched and produced by the Radio Kerry Sports team. This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland Sound and Vision Scheme.
The Greatest Day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group. Proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Next week on The Greatest Day.
This star-studded Kerry team did not have it all their own way early on against the Treaty County. In 1932, Eamon Fitzgerald declined his place in the Kerry squad as he was in training to represent his country at that year's Olympic Games in America.
On his way out, he injured his foot.
One of the greatest displays of football ever witnessed at Croke Park or anywhere.
The Irish press carried the pre-match thoughts of Kerry legend John Joe Sheehy, who stated that he could not see any real danger of defeat.
Tim Landers got possession and crashed into the net. The equalising score. The Kingdom are traditionally strong finishers, but it is doubtful if the spectators expected such a complete transformation in the play when the teams lined out for the second half. Elusive as an eel, hopping like a rubber ball, quick to strike as a serpent in attack. He made Bohareens through the Mayo defence. Kerry remains the peerless group of Gaelic footballers.